Thank you, George. And thank you, Sangha Live, for inviting me into your community. Really want to extend a warm welcome to each of you in all the places where you are. And yeah, I'm so happy to encounter this new community. And I just want to acknowledge and express huge gratitude to my teachers. That's Joan Sutherland Roshi, Henry Shukman Roshi, and Gregory Kramer. And just before we begin to sit, I'd like to drop a koan into our meditation. And I'll just say a couple of words about koans. So this is an excerpt from the koan commentary of Blue Cliff Record Case 22. And just to say, the koan tradition originated in China well over 1,000 years ago, and it was at a cataclysmic time in Chinese history. And in the space of about 10 years, half of the population died of famine, disease, war, invasions, rebellions. So there was this really sudden, profound loss and uncertainty and tenuousness, which is sort of familiar to us today in some ways. And there was actually also a persecution of Buddhism going on. And the libraries were being burnt, books were being lost, and monastics were forced into lay life, and thousands of temples and shrines were destroyed. So the teachings needed to change form and become really compact and portable and easily memorized in order to survive and be transmitted. And this is part of how koans came into being. So yeah, I'll read this koan. It's like a little story. And I just want to invite you to pay attention to your response, maybe a physical response in the body or association or an image that arises in the mind, a memory that pops up. So just notice if anything jumps out or if there's a strong reaction in one direction or another. And if so, you might like to take that word or phrase or image into your meditation. And if not much jumps out to meet you, that's fine too. So here we go. This is a story from late in the Tang Dynasty in China. Two men, Yento and Shuifeng, were really good friends. And they were monastics. And as was common in those days, they would go on these huge long pilgrimages on foot together to visit the great teachers of the time. And one time they were on the road and they got snowed in on Tortoise Mountain at a traveler's inn. And day after day, Yento, the quick-witted younger man, just slept, while Shuifeng, the older, more plodding one, constantly sat up in meditation. Finally, Yento yelled at him and said, "Get some sleep. Every day you're on the meditation seat like a clay image." Shuifeng, who was longing for awakening, touched his chest and said, "My heart isn't at peace. I can't fool myself." Suddenly, Yento gave an ear-splitting yell and said, "Don't you know that the family treasure doesn't come in through the gate?" He said, "Let the teaching flow out from your own breast to cover the sky and the earth." And at this, Shuifeng was suddenly enlightened and cried out, "Today, Tortoise Mountain has finally awakened. Tortoise Mountain has found the way." So I'm going to ring a bell and invite us into meditation together. And I'll offer just some light guidance for the first few minutes or so. So pausing for a moment to just slow the momentum of the mind and land here together on this awesome day. And this pause might open the space for an encounter with the present moment. Lovely thing about meditation, we can let go of managing the past and the future and the me in the middle of it all. And there can be this movement toward simplicity and intimacy with just what's emerging right now. Maybe the sensation of weight on the cushion or chair. Maybe that low hum that I didn't notice a moment ago. So just this, right here. Don't know what might arise next. See if there can be a warm curiosity, a soft readiness for whichever sense door might be touched next. In this pause, perhaps we awaken out of identification. The way we get so caught up in what's happening that we're not quite aware. The pause can create a little gap so we're not as merged or lost or caught up. bringing the attention right to the edge of experience, right to the moment as it emerges, as it changes. Staying close and intimate. In a moment, I will invite you to just crack open the eyes, very gradually letting in the light, fuzzy shapes and colors. And as you do this, see if it's possible to keep sensing the body, maybe the hands or the feet, as you open to the sound of my voice and the sounds in the environment. And see if it's possible to keep sensing the hands and the feet as you open the eyes more fully and look around. There can be this tendency once seeing and hearing are happening, they're so compelling that we leave any sense of the body in the dirt. I love what Ajahn Mun says, that in your exploration of the world, never allow the mind to desert the body. In this way, everything will be revealed to you. In your exploration of the world, never allow the mind to desert the body. In this way, everything will be revealed to you. So sorry to cut the meditation short, but we started a bit late and I want to leave enough time for questions and everything. So, and I know a couple of you have arrived since we started, but I'd like to actually read the koan that I dropped into the meditation again, just so that we can hear it afresh. So these two friends are on pilgrimage together, visiting famous teachers. When they got snowed in on Tortoise Mountain, day after day, Yen To, the quick-witted younger man, just slept, while Shui Feng, the older, more plodding one, constantly sat in meditation. Finally, Yen To yelled at him and said, "Get some sleep. Every day you're on the meditation seat like a clay image." Shui Feng, who was longing for awakening, touched his chest and said, "My heart isn't at peace. I can't fool myself." And suddenly, out of nowhere, Yen To gave an ear-splitting yell. And he said, "Don't you know that the family treasure doesn't come in through the gate? Let the teaching flow out from your own breast to cover the sky and the earth." And as happens in some of these koans, Shui Feng was suddenly enlightened and he cried out, "Today, Tortoise Mountain has finally awakened. Tortoise Mountain has found the way." And I chose this koan because it holds a number of the threads that I wanted to bring in and bring together for this talk. And one of those threads is friendship. These two guys are Dharma brothers, they're peers. There are many records and stories of them traveling together. And I just really love that the liberating teaching can come from a good friend. And also that we just don't know the true source of freedom, which direction it might come from. The deepest freedom might not come from getting the family treasure, i.e. the Dharma, or finding the famous teacher. It might actually come from being thwarted in reaching the teacher because of getting stuck in a snowstorm. And it might come from being yelled at really loudly, as well as sitting long hours in meditation. And then rather than getting or receiving the family treasure or the Dharma, Yentō points out that the treasure comes from allowing the Dharma to flow outwards to from your own heart to touch the earth and sky. So it's all topsy-turvy and back to front and way beyond our predictions or expectations, or at least mine. And sometimes it's the very opposite of any predictions or expectations we might have. One of the very first retreats I ever went to was up a mountain in the snow in a remote part of New Mexico. And I actually don't remember anything much about the retreat, but I really recall that afterwards one of the participants told me she had got lost in the snow. She was out walking in the woods and her footsteps were being covered by falling snow, and she couldn't find her way back to the retreat center. So she stopped and she marked a kind of a base camp and very methodically went in each direction. And she was making continuous tracks in the snow so that she could retrace her steps. But none of these forays led her back to the retreat center. And finally, she set out in the one direction she was sure it was not, and lo and behold, found her way back. And I think this part of that retreat is etched in my mind because it's a repeated pattern in my own life. I often find myself surprised and humbled by these kind of polar opposite turnarounds. You know, I think I know something and I'm pretty sure. And then I find that actually the exact opposite is what's true. And I just have to laugh at the way I keep falling for my own certainties again and again. And actually, this happened for me with Insight Dialogue. When I first heard of the idea of talking in pairs during a retreat, I thought, oof, no way, that would ruin everything. That sounds horrible. But I ended up giving it a try because the person who recommended it, I thought of him as a really serious practitioner. So I decided to give it a go. And I know there's a few of you today who are familiar with this practice. And if you're not familiar, in Insight Dialogue, we usually sit together in pairs as peers, as friends, contemplating a thread of Dharma that's been carefully unfurled by the teacher. And having just sat in silence, so we do incorporate solo silent sitting, the idea is to bring our meditation practice right into the Dharma exploration with our partner. The emphasis is on slowing down, letting the habitual mind fall away to the degree we can, and opening a space of not knowing together, and then listening deeply to the moment, to one another, to one's own body, not abandoning or deserting the body. So the focus is on direct experience in the here and now, really staying on that unknowable edge of the moment, rather than bringing in anything we already know or any concepts. And the first thing that really amazed me when I began this practice is that I found that one person's mindfulness actually steadies and amplifies the others. That mindfulness is contagious. It seems to sort of be able to leap across and be strengthened back and forth. So having another meditator there is not only not a distraction, it's actually a tremendous support. The mind can't wander off into reverie about the past or the future as it might when I'm sitting on my own. And with two of us, the presence deepens and clear seeing can arise and be shared. Also, concentration develops surprisingly quickly. So it was the exact opposite of all of my preconceived notions. The other thing we do in Insight Dialogue is look closely at suttas in larger groups and kind of draw on the hive mind, like all the different bees in the hive. And we're doing that in deep meditation together. And it's just incredible what comes out. My own trammeled thinking that I didn't even know was trammeled gets widened by different voices, different experiences, different interpretations, different ways of seeing. And it's so much more alive and rich. And we also tend to teach relationally as well, not just alone, but in twos or threes, so that the relational dharma we're offering springs from that deep dharma friendship. And I just want to give a little bit of background to this, because even though Insight Dialogue has been pioneered over the last 30 or 40 years by Greg Kramer, the notion of friends and peers exploring and talking about the Dharma together is not actually new. It's a frequent feature in the Koan tradition, and it appears in a number of suttas in the Pali Canon. And I wanted to just share two of these because I just find them so beautiful. And they're Majjhima Nikaya 31 and 32. So they both take place in the Gosinga Sala tree wood. So you have Aniruddha, Nandiya, and Kimbila staying together in the Gosinga Sala tree wood, where the Buddha goes to visit them one day. And the Buddha asks whether they get on well with one another. And Aniruddha confirms that he and the other two are living in concord, with mutual appreciation, without disputing, blending like milk and water, viewing each other with kindly eyes. Aniruddha explains that he considers himself fortunate to be living the spiritual life together with such companions as Nandiya and Kimbila, and that to do so is a great gain. He explains that the way they live together is an expression of metta, of loving kindness or friendliness. And in conclusion, he tells the Buddha, "We're different in body, Venerable Sir, but one in mind." And the Buddha then asks whether they're living diligent, ardent, and resolute. In other words, how is your practice going? And Aniruddha confirms that indeed they are. And he says, we do not break out into speech in day-to-day tasks, but every 5 days we sit together all night discussing the Dharma. That is how we abide, diligent, ardent, and resolute. And I just got so excited when I read that these monks are staying up all night talking about the Dharma together and really doing silence for the other, for the majority of the time, for 5 days, but then they stay up all night and share Dharma together. And in the sutta that follows, there's a gathering of senior disciples of the Buddha in the same Gasingasala tree wood. And it says, the Sal Forest Park at Gosinga is lovely. The night is bright. The sal trees are in full blossom and divine scents seem to float on the air. And each disciple is invited to respond to the question, what kind of mendicant or practitioner would beautify this park? And they each respond saying things like, a practitioner who is learned or serene or has few wishes, is content, secluded, leading an ethical life. And then we hear from Mahamoggallana, and he says, it's when two mendicants engage in discussion about the teaching. They question each other and answer each other's questions without faltering. And their discussion on the teaching flows on. That's the kind of mendicant who would beautify this park. And I just find it quite touching and quite radical that we can actually help each other on this Dharma path. We might support each other's awakening in friendship. And this mix of silent sitting and then speech. And in the koan, you have Shui Feng sitting in silent meditation for days and nights whilst his friend sleeps. And it's when Yento yells at him that awakening comes about. And upon awakening, Shui Feng knows the mountain as his own body. He says, Tortoise Mountain has finally awakened. Tortoise Mountain has found a way. And this is the kind of interbeing that Thich Nhat Hanh emphasized, the way we're not separable from one another and not separate from the earth. We all inter-are. He tells that lovely story about the clouds and the loggers and the loggers' lunch and the sawmill and the sunshine all being inseparable from a piece of paper. A piece of paper can't exist without them all. And if any one element like the sunshine was separated out and taken away, we couldn't have the piece of paper. Just thinking how to cut this a little short because I want to take a little bit of time out of the meditation, a little out of the talk so that we're not left too short a time for the questioning. So yes, I'm going to move to Shito, who's a great 8th century Chinese Zen teacher. And he speaks of this interbeing in a way that I really appreciate. He says, don't limit yourself to your own small story. We and everything we perceive are interwoven and not interwoven. And this interweaving continues on and on, while each thing stands in its own place. We and everything we perceive are interwoven and not interwoven. And this interweaving continues on and on, while each thing stands in its own place. And this really stood out for me because Shito is acknowledging that whilst, yes, we're interwoven, we're also not interwoven. We really appear to stand in our own place. And it's such a, this is a sort of tricky part. It can seem so true that we're separate. In Chan or Zen, we use the word intimacy as synonymous with awakening. It points to the possibility of being intimate with each moment's experience. So a moment of intimacy or awakening can't be mine or yours, because it liberates us from the illusion of self and other. The whole distinction between me and what's outside of me, or Shuifeng and Tortoise Mountain, just falls away. And for many of us, it's just a momentary glimpse when the mind is really settled and we experience a crow or a tulip or the sound of a creek in a really intimate way, as if it's the whole world. And when we're able to move with this intimacy continually, this is how Peter Hirschhoff, a Chan scholar, defines awakening in Chan Buddhism. If we don't think of ourselves or others or the world as fixed separate entities, then this kind of intimacy with all things becomes possible. It's a form of love, that kind of mutuality and care. And a part of this ties back to that thread of not knowing that I was mentioning earlier, this capacity and willingness to discover the seemingly familiar afresh, moment by moment. It requires us not to presume we know, and to be open to being surprised, so that the intimacy can be continuous with whatever circumstances or experiences are unfolding. And Suzuki Roshi used to talk about meditation as a soft readiness. And I think that really captures this quality of continuous intimacy, staying engaged and in ongoing relationship with life. And as I come to the close of this talk, I just want to mention a couple of things about our current predicament or situation in the world. I was just so struck recently when I heard the many crises that we're facing described as a breakdown in relationship. The ecological and climate disasters, racial and social injustice, political unrest, the whole history of colonialism, present day exploitation of people, and planetary resources for profit. At its core, it can all be seen as a breakdown in relationship with each other and a breakdown in relationship with the earth. It's kind of the very opposite of knowing ourselves as being interwoven and belonging to the same fabric of life. So it all comes down to how we be in relationship or kinship, a connectedness and care with one another and with the earth. And maybe I'll just share this quote from, this is from Kyle White, who's a Potawatomi scholar and professor at the University of Michigan School for Environment and Sustainability. And he puts it really succinctly. He says, unless we come back to right relationship, to kinship, we're not going to get the solutions that we need long term. There's been so much destruction of right relationship across the board, and it's going to take time. So, yeah, knowing, and not just knowing, but remembering our relatedness is key. Not just for awakening, but also for living together on this earth in a way that's ethical and sustainable. And in a time of so much precariousness and unpredictability that we're in, how might we really remember and embrace the interbeing or interweaving? This whole notion of intimacy and right relationship. So I'm going to end just with this really short poem that many of you will be familiar with. It's from Li Bai, who's also a Tang Dynasty poet. The birds have vanished into the sky, and now the last cloud drains away. We sit together, the mountain and I, till only the mountain remains. Thank you for your kind attention. And I'd be so curious to see if there's responses or questions or whatever surprises or confusions might arise. So, yeah, please do feel free to put a question in the little box. Oh, I think, sorry, I'm not very familiar with this platform. I'm just looking, I have three questions. Okay, thank you, Jorge, Jorge, sorry. Ask a question. Okay, thank you so much for these questions. So this is Mira. What does that mean, the family treasure does not come in the front gate? So much in koans, just to say, it's a wide open field. And I think there's so many ways of interpreting any one phrase. And they can really be worth carrying with you, because they tend to give and give and give if we carry them in our pockets. But for me, the family treasure doesn't come in through the gate, the front gate. It's like through the direction we're expecting. And in our Dharma journey, we so often want to arrive somewhere or get something. And I think what Yen To is pointing to is that it might be the opposite way than what we assume. And we might actually give something from the breast and offer, you know, offer the teachings to cover the earth and sky. It might be a wholly different process than we imagine. I wonder if that feels clear, Mira. And please, who said that? So it's Yen To, who's the younger of the two men, and he's pretty awake. He's known for his being a very bright student. And perhaps the one thing that is often sort of short, you know, it's a whole story that gets shortened, but one of the pieces that might help in understanding this is that before Yen To shouts, you have Shuifeng saying, my heart isn't at peace. I can't fool myself. And there's a longer piece in there where Shuifeng goes through, he starts to list all his peak moments of experience. And, a few years ago with this teacher, this happened. And then I thought I'd reached something here. And so he's sort of talking about moments that feel really important and insightful. And Yen To just bats them out and says, never mention this again for 30 years, you know, just stop right there. And then he says that, don't you know, the family treasure doesn't come in through the front gate. So the fact that that piece often gets left out to make the koan an easier length is maybe where your confusion came in, Mira, because it's not fully clear. So it's Yen To who says that. Oh, Jane is asking about my work with the LGBTQ community. And I have offered an insight dialogue course just for LGBTQ folks because it just felt like it was really time to come together in that community. And I think it can be quite hard for some folks in this community to really feel a sense of belonging in Sangha because there's unintentional assumptions or kind of a subtle form of barrier, really. We've done some retreats with just LGBTQ to come together and have an easier experience of belonging, I think. Looking at the chat. Can someone post the last poem in the chat so The last poem is Li Bai, and it's, let's see, I should probably pull it up in case I get it wrong. The birds have vanished into the sky, and now the last cloud drains away. We sit together, the mountain and I, till only the mountain remains. I'm not sure if I'm missing anything, but do feel free to ask anything that wasn't clear or that you'd like to hear a little more about. Oh, yes, there's somebody asking about Ajahn Mun. Let me just find that again so I get it right. So Ajahn Mun was actually Ajahn Chah's teacher, and he made this fabulous statement. Let's just yes, here it is. So he and I think his teacher began the Thai forest tradition. And this quote is, "In your exploration of the world, never allow the mind to desert the body. In this way, everything will be revealed to you." A really tall order. And I chose it because it's such a helpful piece with insight dialogue. You know, it can be so compelling to engage when you've got another human there and so much nuance in facial expression and then words and language. And I mean, there's just a million things going on. And it's very easy to put all the attention to the outside and to not take the body along for the ride. So one of the kind of trainings for me with Insight Dialogue has been to rebalance that equation so that I'm holding some of my attention here with the body, aware if it's leaning in or not. And this is an ongoing training. I can forget very easily. But yeah, that's the reason that I wanted to bring in Ajahn Mun with his "don't desert the body." So I'm just seeing Joe, would like to hear more about how insight dialogue practice might be applied in daily life. Well, they. So, yeah, insight dialogue practice applied in daily life. I want to just be really honest that it's slow. And maybe it's just that I'm a slow learner. But it's incremental and subtle. And I think slowing down is a habit that we train ourselves in. I see my reactivity and I just like, So there are six insight dialogue guidelines, and pause is the first one, and relax is the second. And I think that training in relax has been huge for me, to just soften with whatever's happening. Check my attitude to whatever's noticed in the pause, and to soften with it, and also hold some attention to the body as I'm engaging. And it's a long, slow process. I hear from other people, like a really close friend of mine has been learning insight dialogue, and she said that she notices she's speaking less and listening more in daily life. And she was very happy with that. There was just more awareness and intentionality about when to speak and how much to speak. Just think if there's anything else. Insight dialogue in daily life. And I probably should also clarify that as a communication tool, that's a secondary kind of function of insight dialogue. It's primarily intended as a tool to deepen into the Dharma. And it does impact our daily lives. It's it just sort of seeps into our way of experiencing one another. But the main thrust is as a Dharma practice. I hope that's enough about daily life. I'm just trying to think if there's anything else that could be said. So Jane is saying, I love the phrase you shared regarding presuming you know. Thanks, Jane. And I just want to say, Jane, that when I was just right before this talk, I thought, oh, I should somehow get in there this other koan that my teacher Joan Sutherland gave us, which is, I wonder what I don't know here. I wonder what I don't know here. I get into an argument with someone and, oh, I wonder what I don't know here. Somebody does something that seems really odd. Oh, I wonder what I don't know here. So I think that can be a beautiful koan around this tendency I have, and I think many of us have, to presume that we do know. That's just a lovely koan that's very portable, that has supported me for 10 or 15 years. I wonder what I don't know here. So it's great to just bring that in those moments of tightening, like somehow holding the question loosens and opens. Whereas when I think I know, it's a much tighter space. I'm just seeing there's another question here. Do you have experience with open-ended inquiry? I've done that in the context of diamond approach and wondering if they're related. Thank you, Ollie. I have a little bit of experience with open-ended inquiry, and I do think they're related. I think probably the main thing is how much meditation is brought in to insight dialogue or the inquiry process. Insight dialogue can really support, I mean, it's sort of made to support us bringing meditation right in. And I think that's not there so much in the Diamond approach. I know there is some sitting, but, you know, with Insight Dialogue, you've got these guidelines, pause, relax, open, attune to emergence, listen deeply and speak the truth. And those you can sort of pull on there, or you can also, you know, unfold them really slowly and keep them as sort of reference points or handles to hold on to. And I think those can really help the inquiry. Just seeing this other question. Love that, never deserting the body. Eckhart Tolle says the same thing, cool. Very satisfying and nurturing. I could listen to your koans and quotes all day. You're a poet. Oh, thank you, Mira. That's very sweet. I'm not really a poet, but I find koans and poems they lodge inside me in ways that other things don't. My partner will say to me, you can remember what a Chinese person from the 12th century said perfectly, but you've forgotten this present day thing. And it's really true. So I have a place in my heart and sort of in my body for koans and poems. I tend to remember them. And I'm so glad that that was nurturing for you. Oh, great question, Marita. How can I have that same attitude towards a person who knows nothing about Insight Dialogue? Whew. Let's see. So much of it is how I hold myself. You know, if I'm not reactive, it supports the other person not to be. Just like if they are reactive, it supports me to be reactive. So just kind of holding myself with that awareness and choicefulness, I think impacts the other to the degree that we impact each other. You know, it's not necessary for them to know about Insight Dialogue or to even speak about Insight Dialogue in order for it to be a powerful presence in the room. It can just be that I'm taking a little longer, slowing down, bringing in kindness. So yeah, the other person actually doesn't need to know it. I mean, it's lovely if they do. Oh, we're just about out of time. Let me just see quickly. Okay. I'm just so grateful for your interaction, everybody, and I wish we had a little more time. I think there is a way that Georges mentioned of having the last few questions be emailed, so I hope that can happen because I'd love to address Sarah and Gwen's final questions here without running over time. So, yeah. Let's just take a minute to breathe together. And, I'd love to just offer a little bit of metta. So yeah, just offering out any merit or benefit from our session today. Maybe letting it flow out from the breast to cover the earth and the sky for the benefit and awakening of all beings in this intricate, intimate web of life. May we all experience wakeful friendship and live together in deep respect with one another and with this beautiful, aching blue-green planet and all of its species. May we be well. Thank you so much, dear ones.